Chapter 33. Silka, Silka, wake up! Yelena shakes Silka gently, waking her from a dreamless sleep. Silka is disorientated. She pulls the blankets up to her chin, attempting to hide, to escape the threat she feels closing in. Silka, it's me, Yelena. You're all right. I just need you to wake up so I can talk to you. Silka registers the voice, drags herself from sleep. Yelena Georgievna, what time is it? What's going on? Silka moves over so Yelena can sit on the bed beside her. It's early morning, but I need to talk to you. Something's happened to Alexander. Silka stares at Yelena, but no words come. During the night, someone came into the ward and beat him up. We don't know how it happened, but he was found unconscious a short while ago. How? How could this happen? Silka sits up, fully awake. Where were the nurses? The staff? How can someone get beaten up in a hospital? Slow down. I don't have all the answers. There was only one nurse on duty and it was a busy night for her. At one point she went for a break and that must have been when someone came in. But didn't another patient see something? Say something? We're still trying to find out how this happened. The nurse came and got me and I wanted to come and tell you straight away. He's been taken to the operating room for assessment. Get dressed and come with me. With gowns wrapped around their clothes and wearing masks, Silka and Yelena enter the operating room and approach the table where Alexander's beaten body lies. Raisa stands beside him. She looks at Silka with sadness and compassion. Silka gently touches Alexander's shoulder. She can't bear how vulnerable he looks. Yelena puts her arm around Silka. What can you tell us, Raisa? Yelena asks. Must have been two of them. I'd say one of them held something, maybe a pillow, over his head, while the other beat him with a piece of wood, judging by the splinters I'm finding. And nobody heard anything. What about the patient beside him? Silka blurts out. Can't answer that, Silka. We'll have to make inquiries, but we have to make a plan, too. She looks at Yelena. Yelena explains. Someone obviously wants him dead, and there's no way of knowing if it's someone, she brings her voice right down, on the inside, or even connected to the authorities. Do you think it's the same person as before? If they found out he's still alive somehow, that's highly possible. But how would they? She stops. She's worried she knows the answer. Raisa says, right now we need to help Alexander. We might have more answers for you later. What are his injuries? Yelena asks again. He was unconscious when found. He has been hit around the head, but I think he's unconscious from being suffocated. Nothing on his body, thankfully, is broken. I'm so sorry, Silka, Raisa says. Why don't you leave us and we'll get you when we're finished here? I'm not leaving, Silka says angrily. All right, says Raisa. Yelena eases Silka a pace or two away from the table. We have to work out how to protect him, Silka says. Several hours later, Silka accompanies Alexander from the operating room to the far corner of the ward, where a screen is placed around his bed. A chair is brought for Silka and she insists she will be his nurse. Neither Yelena nor Raisa argues with her. Food is brought to her, which she barely touches. The hot, calming tea she devours. Yelena checks on the two of them regularly. As the day ends, Yelena tells Silka she has spoken to the man in the bed next to Alexander and found out more. The patient next to Alexander had been threatened by two men when he woke to the sound of wood thumping on flesh. He had received one punch to the mouth to intimidate him into silence. He was told he wasn't to say anything to alert the nurse after they left, in case Alexander wasn't yet dead. The man was shaken and very upset. Whoever it was that carried out the beating must have been waiting in the reception room outside, which is unstaffed at night. They may have bribed or threatened the guards outside the building, and Yelena is reluctant to question them in case she draws attention to the fact that Alexander is still alive. Yelena then confirms the plan they started hashing out overnight. She speaks quietly. We've changed his file to say he has died, and created another file using the name of a recently deceased patient, amending the record to say that patient had been healed. So, as far as the hospital records are concerned, Alexander died from his injuries as a result of a beating. We will keep the screen around his bed for a while and work out the next step. We've told the patient in the next bed that he's contagious and not to come near him. Thank you, Silke says, mind racing. That buys some time, but what's next? It is the best we can do for now, Silke. When Yelena leaves, Silke places her head on the pillow beside Alexander's. The next morning, Silke wakes to see Alexander looking at her. For several moments, their eyes are locked, wordlessly conveying their feelings for each other. They are interrupted by Racer. I see you are both awake. Now, which one should I look at first? Silke smiles. Him, of course. Raisa tries to explain to Alexander his injuries and how he is to be treated. Silke can't help herself and constantly interrupts with her positive spin on his recovery. Alexander says nothing, nodding, looking grateful but worried, echoing Silke's true thoughts. Days pass as Alexander slowly recovers behind the screen. His bruises fade, but movement still causes him pain. When Silke runs into Kirill, going in and out of the reception area, she tries to act friendly and natural, politely declining his advances without making him angry, not wanting to draw any unnecessary attention to the screened area on the ward. She suspects it was him who either assaulted Alexander or alerted the original attacker to the fact that he was still alive, but she has no way to prove it. Alexander happily accepts the pain of getting out of bed to walk with his arms around Silke as she helps him. They are told Silke is not the best nurse to be assisting him, their difference in height more of a hindrance to his recovery than a help. This is not the only advice they ignore. Each night, Silke is found sitting slumped in a chair, her head on his pillow, sound asleep. She has barely left his side since the beating. The number of patients in the hospital has begun to slow, and word reaches the staff that numbers in the gulag are reducing significantly. Prisoners are being released early, on the orders of General Secretary Khrushchev, who has succeeded Stalin. He is reaching out to the West. The stain the gulag system has placed over his empire is becoming known, and appeasement is required to continue talks with non-communist countries. Alexander is able to walk on his own now, and the screen has become conspicuous, drawing questions from patients and staff about how bad the infection is behind it. They need to work out the next step. Silke, can I see you a moment? Yelena calls one morning. I'll be right back, Silke tells Alexander. Yelena steers Silke into the dispensary. Nothing good ever happened in this room, what is it? A concerned Silke asks. Do you trust me? Yelena asks. More than anyone I've ever known besides my family. Then I need you to trust me now. Alexander will be discharged in 2 days' time. No, you can't, you promised, Silke cries. Listen to me. Not out into the prison population, where someone would notice he's not the dead man whose name and number we've assigned him. He will be discharged to a hut nearby, where he'll be safe. I want you to trust that I'm doing all I can to help. Silke is speechless. This is a good thing. He will be safe. But again, someone is being taken away from her. She tries to smile. You are so good, Yelena Georgievna. I am grateful. He will be grateful. Yelena looks troubled, in a way Silke has never seen before. She is always stoic, practical, and positive. Silke, there's something else. Silke's heart sinks. I've put in a request to move to Sochi, where they have built a new hospital. She reaches her arm out for Silke, but Silke flinches. She doesn't know what to say. Yelena deserves to be somewhere better after the years she has voluntarily put into this awful place. But what will Silke do without her? Silke. Silke can't look at her. She is holding everything back. She has never had any choices. Everything has simply happened to her. No matter how much she wants it, she can never hold on to people. She is alone, completely alone in the world. Silke, you have to believe I am doing everything I can for you too. Silke pushes her feelings down inside her, looks up at Yelena. Thank you, Yelena Georgievna, for everything. Yelena holds her eyes. It feels like goodbye. The women of Hut 29 are all she has left. Silke keeps thinking about Lale in Birkenau, how he had told her she was brave, how other people have told her she is brave, how Alexander has opened something up in her, making her want to live, not just stay alive. And she knows there is one more brave thing she has to do. She talks to the trustees who act as guards for the nurses' quarters, gives them her stash of extra food, and they agree to escort her that night, a Sunday, to the hut. She needs to talk to the women. As they walk through the compound, she can see men eyeing her from a distance, but they do not approach. She opens the door to the hut, while the guards wait outside. Silke! Margareta rushes towards her, enveloping her. What are you doing here? It's dangerous! Silke begins to shake. I need to talk to you all. She looks around. There are a couple of new faces, but the hut is still mostly women she recognises, including her oldest hutmates, Elena and Margareta. Please, sit down, she says. Is everything all right? Elena says. It is, Silke begins. Well, I have met someone, and I feel something for him, and I may lose him yet, but I never even knew I would be able to feel something for a man because of everything I have been through. The women sit politely. Elena gives Silke an encouraging look. You all shared your pasts with me, your secrets, and I was too afraid, but I should have reciprocated. I owe it to you. She takes a deep breath. I was in Auschwitz, Silke says. Margareta sits bolt upright. The concentration camp. She swallows. I survived because I was given a privileged position in the camp, in the women's camp in Birkenau. A bit like Antonina, but... Elena nods at her. Go on, Silke. No one else speaks. I had my own room in the block. A block where they would put the... She struggles to say the words. Sick and the dying women before they would take them to the gas chambers to murder them. The women have their hands over their mouths, unbelieving. The SS officers, they put me there in that block because there were no witnesses. Silence. Complete silence. Silke swallows again, feeling light. Dizzy. Anastasia starts to cry, audibly. I know that sound, Anastasia. It is so familiar to me, Silke says. I used to get angry. I don't know why that emotion, but they were all just so helpless. I wasn't able to cry. I had no tears. And this is why I have not been able to tell you all. I had a bed. I had food. And they were naked and dying. How long were you there? Elena asks. 3 years. Margareta comes to sit near Silke and holds out a hand. None of us know what we would have done. Did those bastards kill your family? I put my mother on the death cart myself. Margareta forcefully takes Silke's hand. The memory is giving you a shock. I can tell by your voice and your shaking. Elena, make a cup of tea. Elena jumps up and goes to the stove. The rest of the women remain quiet. But Silke is now too numb to think about how her words have been received. There's an exhaustion taking over her. Such a small space of time has passed, but the words have been so large. When Elena returns with the tea, she says, Hannah knew, didn't she? Silke nods. Margareta says, I hope this isn't more of a shock, Silke, but many of us had guessed that you had been there. You being Jewish, not talking about your arrest. Silke begins shaking again. Really? Yes, and things you would say here and there.
Oh.
You survived it, Silke, Elena says, and you will survive here, too.
Anastasia, the youngest, still has her hand over her mouth, silent tears falling down her cheeks. But none of them has reacted as Silke had always played over in her mind, had always feared. They are still beside her. And so maybe she can tell Alexander too. Maybe he can know her and still love her.
I'd better go, Silke says.
Elena stands with her. Come back again if you can. Silke lets Elena put her arms around her, and Margareta. Anastasia still seems too shocked. Silke goes out into the night, dizzy and trembling. Good morning. Silke greets the receptionist as she heads towards the ward. She has one more day with Alexander. She doesn't know yet how she can possibly say goodbye. Will she dare to promise that she will try to find him, many years from now, on the outside? Or should she just accept her fate, her curse? But though she is losing him, losing Yelena, and though she has lost everyone dear to her, Alexander has kindled a fire within her. Not to anger, but to something like hope. Because she never thought she could fall in love, after all she's been through. To do so, she thought, would be a miracle. And now she has. Silke, the receptionist says. Silke turns back. I've been asked to tell you to go to the main administration block. They want to see you. Silke pulls her hand back from the door to the ward.
Now.
Alexander is just inside. She could say good morning first. No, she'll get this out of the way and then have the day with him before he is discharged. A day where she can tell him everything and then never speak of it again. Entering the administration block, Silke is confronted by several other prisoners, all men, standing around complaining about why they are here. She reports to the only person looking official, behind a desk. I've been asked to report here, she says, with a confidence she doesn't feel. Name?
Cecilia Klein.
Number? 1-B494. The receptionist rifles through several envelopes on her desk. Taking one, she looks at the number printed on it. 1-B494. Here. There's a small sum of money in there and a letter to hand to the guard at the gate on your way out. Silke doesn't take the offered envelope. Take it and get out of here, the receptionist snaps at her.
Where am I going?
First to Moscow, then to be deported to your home country, the receptionist says.
Home?
I am to go to the train station.
Yes, now get out of here. Next!
The bulb in the ceiling blinks. Another piece of paper. Another moment where her life is decided for her.
But I can't just leave. There are people I need to see.
Alexander. Will he be released? Released under the dead man's name? How will she find him? Her chest aches, feels like it's collapsing in on itself. Yelena, Raisa, Lyuba, Elena, Anastasia, and Margareta, if she could get to them. She needs to say goodbye. Klavdia Arsenyevna is there, overseeing the prisoner's release. Silke has seldom seen her since moving into the nurse's quarters. Now the guard steps forward. You are lucky, Silke Klein, but do not test my patience. You are to leave immediately, not to go anywhere but the front gate, or I can arrange for a guard to drag you to the hole, if that's what you would prefer.
Silke takes the envelope, shaking. The men behind her have all gone quiet.
Next, says the receptionist. Silke hands the letter to the guard at the gate, who barely glances at it, indicating with his head for her to move on. Slowly, she walks away, looking around for someone to stop her, tell her it's all a mistake. The few guards she passes ignore her. On she walks, down the only road she sees. Alone,
The heavy clouds roll in. Silka prays it doesn't snow today. In the distance, she can see small buildings. Homes, she thinks. She walks on, aching with sadness, but dizzy also at the strangeness of this freedom, this road in front of her. One foot, the next. What do people do with this? Walking down a street with houses and a few shops, she peers into windows. Women with children, cleaning, playing, cooking, eating, look out at her suspiciously. She catches the rich smells of stew and baking bread. She hears a familiar sound, a train slowly pulling in behind the buildings, and hurries towards it. By the time she reaches the railway line, the train is disappearing. Her eyes follow the tracks to a small station. She goes to it. A man is in the process of closing and locking the door to a small office.
"Excuse me."
The man pauses with his key in the door, stares down at her. "What do you want?"
"Where was that train going?"
"Moscow, eventually."
"And among the released prisoners, did you happen to see a man, tall, slight bruising on his face?"
The man cuts her off. "It was full. There were many men. I'm sorry. I wouldn't be able to tell you." Silka opens the envelope stuffed in her coat pocket. She pulls all the money out.
"Can I have a ticket for the next train, please?"
Josie and Natya are in Moscow. If all the trains went to Moscow, then in Moscow, she could look for them, and eventually also for Alexander. If only she could remember the name of Maria Danilovna's friend. It will be very difficult to track her down, but she can try. She will.
"It's not due yet, but all you need is your release paper and movement order."
"When will it come?"
"Tomorrow. Come back tomorrow."
Silka is totally deflated, exhausted, desperate.
"Where will I stay?"
she says, close to tears.
"Look, I can't help you. You'll just have to do what all the others like you have done. Find somewhere warm to hole up in and come back tomorrow."
"Can I stay here somewhere?"
"No, but look out for the police. They patrol day and night looking for your type. You prisoners. Some of them have caused trouble stealing from shops and homes while waiting for the train."
Silka is crushed. She turns away, walks back to town. Other prisoners have also been released and been told by the station master to return the next day. They wander the streets. They get into trouble with the locals. Blood is spilled. Silka doesn't offer to help, choosing to stay apart. She still doesn't believe she is free. Maybe the world is just a wider prison, where she has no family and no friends and no home. She has had Alexander. Is her life to be spent wondering about him, the way she wonders about her father, about Gita, about Josie? How will she really find Josie in a huge city like Moscow? At least she knows Yelena will be safe, but she didn't get to say goodbye, to hug her, to thank her properly. She feels wrenched in two. She spends the night behind a shop, curled up in a doorway, in an attempt to keep out of the icy wind. She hears the commotion of dozens of people yelling before she hears the train. The fog in her head clears with the realization night has become day. Her transport out of Vorkuta is pulling into the station. She joins the others, running, all heading to the same place. The train has beaten her to the station and stands waiting, its engine running. She is pushed and jostled and knocked to the ground several times. Picking herself up, she keeps moving. The queue for the doors is long. The station master has left his room and walks up the line of waiting passengers, checking their papers. No ticket is handed over. Silka takes the form from her pocket and holds it out for him. The station master's hand reaches for it.
"Thank you,"
she says to him. With one hand on hers, he smiles down at her and nods encouragement.
"Good luck out there, little one. Now get on that train."
Silka rushes towards the open carriage door. As she is about to step up into the train, she is pushed heavily aside by two men wanting to board ahead of her. The compartment is looking very full. She reaches her arms into the scrabble, desperately trying to get a hold on the doors so she can swing in. The train whistle calls, warning them all to get on board. There is yelling and pushing in front of her, and a man falls from the pack, back off the carriage steps, and lands on the ground, twisted beside her.
"Are you all right?" she says, letting go of the door and reaching down to him.
People continue to shove and swarm around them. He looks up, and beneath the hat are the startled brown eyes of Alexander.
"Silke!"
She reaches under his arms to help him up, her heart thumping wildly in her chest.
"Oh, Alexander, are you all right?"
she repeats, her voice choked with tears. He winces as he stands, the stream of people behind them thinning out. Her hands are still under his arms. The train whistle sounds again. She looks to the door. A small gap has opened in the crowd.
"Let's go," she says.
Her hand goes to his, and they climb onto the train together, Alexander's foot clearing the platform just as it starts moving. In the carriage, Alexander puts his arms around Silke. She weeps, openly, into his chest.
"I can't believe it," she says.
She looks up into his eyes, soft and kind. "I can," he says. He strokes her hair, wipes the tears from her cheeks. In his eyes, she can see everything he has been through, and reflected, her own eyes, and everything she has been through.
"It is time to live now, Silke," he says, "without fear and with the miracle of love."
"Is that a poem?" she asks him, smiling through her tears.
"It is the beginning of one."
Epilogue. Košice, Czechoslovakia, January 1961. The bell dings on the cafe door, and in walks a glamorous, tanned woman with a heart-shaped face, painted lips, and large brown eyes. Another woman, with curls in her hair and showing her curves in a lively floral dress, stands up from a table to greet her. Gita walks towards Silke, and the two women, who have not seen each other for almost 20 years, embrace. They are so different to how they were back then. Now they are warm and healthy. The moment is overwhelming. They pull back. Silke looks at Gita's lustrous curled brown hair, her plump cheeks, her shining eyes.
"Gita, you look incredible."
"Silke, you are beautiful, more beautiful than ever." For a long time, they simply look at each other, touch each other's hair, smile, tears leaking from their eyes. Will they be able to talk about that other place, that time? The waitress comes over and they realise they must look a sight, pouring at each other, crying and laughing. They sit down and order coffee and cake, sharing more looks, delighting in the knowledge that these are things they were not allowed, that it is still a daily miracle to have survived. These simple pleasures will taste different for them to anyone else in this cafe. First, Silke asks about Lale and is delighted to hear about how he and Gita found each other in Bratislava after the war, what they went through after that, and how they have settled in Australia. Gita only stops smiling when she says that they've been trying a long time for a baby with no success. She touches her stomach, reflexively, under the table as she says this. "Alexander and I, too, have had no success," Silke says, reaching out to clutch her friend's other hand. And then, working backwards, Gita asks, voice lowered, huddling in closer, if Silke would like to talk about the gulag.
"It is where I met Alexander," Silke says,
"and made other friends, too." It is too hard to articulate the relentless, bone-chilling cold, the constant flow of sick and injured and dead prisoners, the rapes she again endured, the humiliation and pain of being imprisoned there, after the other place.
"Silke," Gita says, "I don't know how you could bear it, after everything we'd already been through."
Silke lets the tears run down her cheeks. She never speaks about this with anyone. No one around her, other than Alexander, know she was in Auschwitz, except for her only Jewish neighbour, who had been hidden as a little boy all throughout the Shoah. And few people know she was in Siberia. She has done her best to put the past behind her, create a new life. I know the people who came in after us to Birkenau, they just didn't understand what it had been like to be there for so long. Gita continues to hold Silke's hand. You were 16, and you had lost everything.
We were faced only with impossible choices, Silke says.
The sun shines in through the cafe window. The past is seen through a muted grey light, cold and never as far away as they'd like. The images and smells are near the surface of their skin, every moment of loss. But they turn their faces to the sun coming in. Gita brings the conversation back to Lale, to their business ventures and to the Australian Gold Coast where they holiday. She spoons cake into her mouth, closing her eyes with pleasure, the way Alexander still does when he smokes or eats. And Silke joins in, talking of the present, of living. They lift their glasses and toast.
L'chaim.
Note from Heather Morris. Did I tell you about Silke? No, Lale, you didn't. Who was Silke? She was the bravest person I ever met. Not the bravest girl, the bravest person. And? She saved my life. She was beautiful, a tiny little thing, and she saved my life. A brief conversation, a few words thrown at me one day while I was talking to Lale about his time in Auschwitz-Birkenau as the tattooist of Auschwitz. I returned to the topic of Silke many times with Lale. I held his hand as he explained to me how she saved his life and what she did to be in a position to save his life. He was distraught, remembering, and I was shocked. This was a girl who was 16 years of age. Just 16. I became captivated by Silke, unable to understand or comprehend the strength someone of her age must have had to survive the way she did. And why did she have to be punished so harshly for choosing to live? I listened to Gita on her Shoah tape talking about Silke, though she does not use her name, the role she had in the camp, including in Block 25, and how Gita felt she was judged unjustly. I knew the girl who was the Block Alteste. She lives now in Košice. Everyone says she was this and she was that, but she only had to do what the SS told her. If Mengele told her this person has to go to Block 25, she would take her in, you know? She couldn't cope with so many people. But those people don't understand who haven't been there the whole time and didn't go through the stages of what's going on. So they say one was bad, one was good, but this I told you. You save one and the other one had to suffer. Block 25, you couldn't get out anybody. She also mentioned how she had visited her after, in Košice, and Lale also told me that she had. I searched testimonies of other survivors for reference to Silke. I found them. Did they bring me comfort? No, they did not. I found conflicting comments, such as, she did bad things to survive, she gave me extra rations when she found out I came from the same town as her, she yelled and screamed at the condemned women, she smuggled me food when I was certain I would die of hunger. A picture of a very young woman surviving in a death camp, submitting herself to the sexual advances of not one, but two senior SS officers, was emerging. A story of bravery, compassion, friendship, a story like Lale's, where you did what you did in order to survive. Only the consequences for Silke were to be imprisoned for another 10 years in the coldest place on Earth, Vorkuta Gulag, inside the Arctic Circle, Siberia. With the release of the tattooist of Auschwitz, floods of emails, messages arrived from around the world. The vast majority of them asked the question, what happened to Silke? With the support of my editors and publishers, I began the research that would lead me to uncovering the story
that has inspired this novel. I engaged a professional researcher in Moscow to uncover details of life in Vorkuta, the gulag where Silke spent 10 years. I travelled to Košice and, at the invitation of the owners of the apartment where Silke and her husband had lived for 50 years, I sat surrounded by the four walls Silke called home. The owner told me she felt Silke's presence in the apartment for many months after she moved in. I sat and talked to her neighbours, Mr. and Mrs. Samuelli, both in their 90s. They shared stories of living next door to Silke and her husband for many decades. I met another neighbour who shared the name Klein. He told me he and Silke were the only Jewish people in the building. They would speak softly together on significant Jewish days of celebration. They shared a hope that they might one day visit Israel. Neither ever did, he said. At the town cemetery, I visited the graves of Silke and her husband and paid my respects, placed flowers, lit a candle. With translators and one of my publishers, I travelled to Sabinov, an hour's drive north of Košice, where we got to see the birth extracts of Silke and her sisters. We were shown the marriage certificate of her parents and learned the names of her grandparents. In Bardejov, where Silke and her family had lived and were transported from, we read reports from the school Silke and her sisters attended. They were all rated excellent for behaviour and manners. Silke shone in both mathematics and sport. I wandered through the streets of the old town, stood outside the home where Silke once lived, ran my hand along the remnants of the city wall that protected the residents for hundreds of years from invading enemies, unable to protect Silke from the request to submit to the Nazis. Such a beautiful place, a peaceful place, in 2019. I am comforted by the knowledge Silke spent nearly 5 decades with the man she loved, and according to her friends and neighbours, had a good life. Mrs. Samuelli told me how Silke would talk about her love for her husband with the female friends in their circle. She would be teased by the other women who did not share such passionate feelings of love towards their husbands. When writing of the rape, yes, there is no other word for it, in Auschwitz-Birkenau, I found very little documented in the film testimonies. What I did find were papers written more recently when female interviewers spoke to survivors about this subject. How they uncovered the deep shame these women had lived with for many decades, never speaking of the abuse, never being asked the question, were you ever sexually assaulted by the Nazis? The shame is ours, not theirs. They lived for decades with the truth, the reality of what happened to them, buried deep within. Time is up. It is time these crimes of rape and sexual abuse were called out for what they were. Crimes often denied as they were not official Nazi policy. I found specific mention even of Schwarzhuber as a smirking lecher from a female inmate physician, and I have read in one testimony it was rumoured she, Silke, received SS Unterscharführer Taube. While millions of Jewish men, women and children died, many lived and carried the burden of their suffering, too ashamed to mention it to their families, their partners. To deny it happened is to stick your head in the sand. Rape is a long-established weapon of war and oppression. Why should the Nazis, one of the most vicious regimes the world has ever known, forswear this particular form of cruelty? I was humbled to have Lale Sokolov in my life for 3 years and hear his story firsthand. I did not have this luxury with Silke. Determined to tell her story, to honour her, I found a way to weave the facts and reportage of her circumstances in both Auschwitz-Birkenau and the Vorkuta Gulag with the testimonies of others, particularly women. To navigate the fictional and factual elements required to create a novel, I created characters based on what I discovered through reading and research into what life was like in these camps. There is a mix of characters inspired by real-life figures, in some instances representing more than one individual, and characters completely imagined. There are more characters based on real-life figures in the Auschwitz-Birkenau sections, as I learned about them from Lale. History never gives up its secrets easily. For over 15 years, I've been finding out about the amazing lives
of ordinary people, under the most unimaginable of circumstances. It's a journey that's taken me from the suburbs of Melbourne, Australia, to the streets of Israel, from small towns in the hills of Slovakia to the railroad tracks at Auschwitz-Birkenau and the buildings beyond. I've spoken to people who lived through these terrible days. I've spoken to their family and friends. I've seen meticulous records from Yad Vashem and the Shoah Foundation and handwritten documents in civil archives dating back to the 19th century. They all paint a picture, but sometimes the picture isn't clear and often the details don't all line up. The challenge of working with history is to find the core of what was true and the spirit of those who lived then. Days before Silke's journey was due to go to the printers, new facts were uncovered concerning her parents. They didn't relate to her time in the Nazi or Soviet camps, but they did shed new light on this remarkable woman and where she came from. It was a reminder to me that the story of Silke's journey is far from fully told, even with the story you've just heard. Stories like Silke's deserve to be told, and I'm humbled and honoured to bring it to you. She was just a girl who became a woman, who was the bravest person Lale Sokolov ever met. Additional information. Cecilia Silke Klein was born in Sabinov, eastern Slovakia, on the 17th of March, 1926. Her mother was Fania Kleinova, née Blekova. Her father, Miklaus Klein, born 13th of January, 1895. Silke was the youngest of three daughters of Miklaus. Olga was born to Miklaus and Cecilia Blekova on the 28th of December, 1921. It appears that Cecilia Blekova, born 19th of September, 1897, died on the 26th of March, 1922, and that Miklaus then married Cecilia's sister, Fania Blekova, born the 10th of May, 1903, on the 1st of November, 1923. Miklaus and Fania had two daughters, Magdalena, Magda, born the 23rd of August, 1924, and Cecilia, Silke. And Fania would also have raised Olga as her own daughter. Silke was named for her aunt, and Olga was both her and Magda's cousin, and their half-sister. In the fictional narrative, Silke's sisters are represented as one character, Magda. On the registry of birth for each of the girls, Miklaus is listed as non-domiciled, meaning that he was Hungarian. Czechoslovakia was created at the end of the First World War when the Austro-Hungarian Empire ceased to exist, and eastern Slovakia sat on the border of this newly created nation and Hungary. Miklaus Klein was born in the northern Hungarian town of Sikse, 100 miles south of Sabinov. Miklaus was never during his life regarded as a Czechoslovakian citizen. At some point before 1931, the family moved to Bardejov, where each of the girls attended the local school. The family are known to have lived in Klastorska Street and Halusova Street. Miklaus's occupations on his daughter's birth certificates and their school records vary wildly. He is a salesman, a tradesman, an industrial business employee, and latterly, a driver. It seems that he worked for a Mr. Rosner in Bardejov, possibly as his driver. When the Second World War broke out, Germany annexed what is now the Czech Republic. Hungary sided with the Germans and what is now Slovakia capitulated. While people at this time would have still identified themselves in an official context as Czechoslovakian, the country was divided in two, and Hungary also took control of an area in the southeast. This meant that the fate of the Jewish people of Czechoslovakia varied according to which part of the country they were living in. The Jews of Hungary were sent to the camps in 1944. In survivor testimonies, people from the area often refer to themselves as Slovakian or Slovak, and so in the narrative I have used both Czechoslovakia and Slovakia, Slovak, depending on official or personal context. Likewise, people from the Czech region might identify themselves as Czech, and Slovakian and Czech were, and are, separate but very similar languages. Both are West Slavic languages and are closely related to Polish. When visiting Silke's hometown of Bardejov, I learned that she would also have understood Russian, through exposure to the Rusyn dialect. In 1942, the Nazis set about rounding up the Jews of the region of Slovakia. All Jewish people in Badajoz were ordered to go to Poprad, from where they were put into cattle wagons bound for Auschwitz. Miklaus and the three girls entered Auschwitz on the 23rd of April, 1942, where Silke was given prisoner number 5907. There is no record of Fania Kleinever having gone to Auschwitz, but witness testimonies and Lale Sokolov describe Silke having seen her mother put on the death cart at Birkenau. In reality, they most likely all left Badajoz on the same date and waited in Poprad for transports. Silke's occupation at the time of her entry to Auschwitz is listed as tailor. Her older sisters are housewives. In the novel, I have imagined the daughters going earlier than their parents, as this happened in many instances, where each Jewish family was ordered to send able-bodied young people over the age of 16 to go and work. The entire family, bar Silke and her mother, are listed in the Yad Vashem archive as having been murdered in the Shoah. We do not know when Miklaus, Fania, Magda and Olga were murdered, but we do know that only Silke survived Auschwitz. In one record I have uncovered, Silke too is listed as having been murdered in Auschwitz, but this is also the case with Lale Sokolov, and we know that both survived and made it back to Czechoslovakia. At the end of the war, the Russians liberated Auschwitz-Birkenau, and it seems that at this point, Silke was taken to Montelupich prison in Krakow, possibly after going through an NKVD filtration interrogation point. This has been simplified in the novel, where she was given a sentence for collaboration, which I understand is because of her role in Block 25 and being pointed out as having slept with the enemy. This is how Lale understood it. From there, she made the long, arduous journey to Vorkuta in the Arctic Circle. Certain aspects of her time there I have taken from reportage. Her job in the hospital, being taken under the wing of a female doctor, going out on the ambulance. Alexei Kuktikov and his wife are loosely based on real people. Kuktikov was director of both of Vorkuta's prison camps, Vorkutlag and Rechlag, and during his time there commissioned the building of a children's hospital, built by prisoners, of course. Upon her release, I believe Silke was sent to either Pankrach or Ruzhinya prison, both of which are in Prague, before eventually returning to Czechoslovakia. There is an entry on her birth certificate in 1959 granting her Czechoslovakian citizenship. Silke was back home, and life with a man she loved, whom she met in the Gulag, could begin. Alexander is an entirely fictional creation, and I have not included the name of the man she met in Vorkuta and subsequently married, in order to protect the privacy of his descendants. Silke and her husband settled in Košice, where Silke lived until her death on the 24th of July, 2004. They never had children, but those I have met who knew them spoke of their great love for one another. Heather Morris, October 2019. Afterward by Owen Matthews. Vorkuta, the White Hell. Silke's last sight of the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp would have been of the wrought iron sign erected over the gates, Arbeit macht frei, work brings freedom. The first thing she would have seen on her arrival in the Soviet Gulag camp at Vorkuta was another sign, work in the USSR is a matter of honour and glory. Another declared that, with an iron fist, we will lead humanity to happiness. A taste for sadistic irony was just one of the many traits that Nazi Germany and Stalin's USSR shared. Both Hitler's concentration camps and the Soviet Gulag existed for the same purpose, to purge society of its enemies and to extract as much work from them as possible before they died. The only real differences are one of scale, Stalin's Gulag was far larger than anything Hitler ever conceived, and of efficiency. Stalin certainly shared Hitler's genocidal tendencies, condemning entire ethnic groups, such as the Chechens, Crimean Tatars, and Volga Germans, to mass deportation, death marches, and forced labour.
but where the Germans used Zyklon B poison gas, Stalin preferred to let cold, hunger and overwork do their lethal work. Over 18 million people passed through the Gulag system from 1929 until Stalin's death in 1953, according to the Soviet state's own meticulous records. Of those, modern scholars estimate that some 6 million died either in prison or shortly after their release. Like Hitler's concentration camps, Stalin's Gulag housed both political prisoners and common criminals, as well as people condemned for belonging to politically unreliable nations, such as Poles, Jews, and Ukrainians, or to the wrong class, whether wealthy peasants or pre-revolutionary aristocrats. In the closing days of the Second World War, the Gulag population was swelled by German war criminals and ordinary German prisoners of war, as well as hundreds of thousands of Soviet soldiers who had chosen surrender over death and were therefore presumed to be collaborators with the enemy. During Silke's time in Vorkuta, her fellow prisoners included the commander of Germany's Sachsenhausen concentration camp, Anton Kindl, famous Yiddish, French and Estonian writers, Russian art scholars and painters, Latvian and Polish Catholic priests, East German Liberal Democrats, and even a British soldier who had fought with the Waffen-SS British Free Corps. Alongside the intellectuals and war criminals were a large population of murderers, rapists, and even convicted cannibals. Nobel Prize-winning author Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag's most famous victim and its most dedicated chronicler, described Stalin's system of forced labour camps as the Gulag Archipelago. The word is appropriate, as the camps spread across the Soviet Union's 11 time zones like a string of interconnected islands. There were gulags in Russia's biggest cities, some housing German prisoners of war serving as slave labourers, and others where imprisoned engineers and scientists toiled in high-tech prison laboratories. But most gulags were located in the remotest corners of the Siberian North and in the Far East. Indeed, whole swathes of the USSR were effectively colonised by state prisoners who built dozens of brand new cities, roads, railways, dams and factories where there had previously been just bleak wasteland. Vorkuta was such a colony, both in the sense of a penal settlement and a tiny island of life in a hostile, unexplored territory. In the late 1920s, Soviet geologists identified vast coal deposits in the frozen Taiga wilderness, an area too cold for trees to grow, where the Pechora River flowed into the Arctic Sea. The region was some 1,900 kilometres, 1,200 miles, north of Moscow, and 160 kilometres, 99 miles, above the Arctic Circle. Soviet secret police lost no time in arresting a leading Russian geologist, Nikolai Tikhanovich, and setting him to work organising an expedition to sink the first mine in the area. In the early summer of 1931, a team of 23 men set off northward from Uchta by boat. Prisoner geologists led the way, ordinary prisoners manned the oars, and a small secret police contingent was in command. Paddling and marching through the swarms of insects that inhabit the tundra in summer months, the party built a makeshift camp. The heart compressed at the sight of the wild, empty landscape, recalled one of the prisoner specialists, a geographer named Kolevsky. The absurdly large, black, solitary watchtower, the two poor huts, the tiger and the mud. The beleaguered group somehow survived their first winter, when temperatures often fell to 40 degrees below zero, and the sun did not rise above the horizon for the four-month-long polar night. In the spring of 1932, they sank the first mine at Vorkuta, using only picks and shovels and wooden carts. Stalin's purges, the mass arrests of suspect party members and of politically unreliable wealthy peasants, began in 1934, and provided the mass of slave labour needed to turn this desolate site into a major industrial centre. By 1938, the new settlement contained 15,000 prisoners and had produced 188,206 tonnes of coal. Vorkuta had become the headquarters of Vorkutlag, a sprawling network of 132 separate labour camps
that covered over 90,000 square kilometres, an area larger than Ireland. By 1946, when Silke arrived, Vorkutlag housed 62,700 inmates and was known as one of the largest and toughest camps in the entire Gulag system. An estimated 2 million prisoners passed through Vorkuta's camps between 1931 and 1957. An estimated 200,000 of them perished from disease, overwork, and malnourishment in the Arctic conditions. By the 1940s, Vorkuta had been connected to the rest of Russia by a prisoner-built railway. There is still no road to Vorkuta, even today. A brand new city had been built on the unstable permafrost, the deep-lying soil that never thaws, even in the height of summer. The city boasted a geological institute and a university, theatres, puppet theatres, swimming pools and nurseries. The guards and administrators lived lives of comparative luxury. Life was better than anywhere else in the Soviet Union, remembered Andrei Chaborkin, a foreman in the neighbouring nickel mining gulag of Norilsk. All the bosses had maids, prisoner maids. Then the food was amazing. There were all sorts of fish. You could go and catch it in the lakes. And if in the rest of the Union there were ration cards, here we lived virtually without cards. Meat, butter, if you wanted champagne you had to take a crab as well. There were so many. Caviar, barrels of the stuff lay around. For the prisoners, however, the living conditions were shockingly different. Most lived in flimsy wooden barracks with unplastered walls, the cracks stopped up with mud. The inside space was filled with rows of knocked-together bunk beds, a few crude tables and benches, with a single sheet metal stove. One photo of a women's hut does show single beds and embroidery strung around the hut, as in this narrative. In photographs of Vorkuta taken in the winter of 1945, the barracks are almost invisible. Their steeply sloping roofs come almost to the ground so that the snow accumulating around them would insulate them from the bitter Arctic cold. Almost all survivors speak of the terrible heavy smell that pervaded the barracks. Few gulags had any kind of laundry facilities, so filthy and mildewed clothes would lie drying along the edge of the bunks, the tables, and on every available surface. At night, prisoners use a parasha, a communal bucket, in place of a toilet. One prisoner wrote that in the morning the parasha was impossible to carry, so it was dragged along across the slippery floor. The contents invariably spilled out. The stench made it almost impossible to breathe. In the centre of most of Vorkutlag's 100-plus camps was a large open parade ground where the prisoners stood to attention twice a day to be counted. Nearby was a mess hall where prisoners were fed a daily soup made of spoiled cabbage and potatoes, sometimes with pieces of pig fat, sometimes with herring heads, or fish or animal lungs and a few potatoes. The convicts' area was usually surrounded by double rings of barbed wire, patrolled by Alsatian guard dogs and surrounded by guard towers. Beyond the wire were the guards' barracks and administrators' houses. Who were the guardians of this nightmare world? Where did this wolf tribe appear from among our own people? Alexander Solzhenitsyn asked. Does it really stem from our own roots, our own blood? It is ours. Some of the guards in the gulag were themselves former prisoners. Many more convicts served as druzhniki, the prisoner trustees who were given extra food for their role in keeping order in the camp and informing on potential troublemakers. Most guards, though, were professional secret policemen who volunteered for the service. The men drawn to serve in the Soviet secret police, in the famous phrase of its founder, Felix Dzerzhinsky, could be either saints or scoundrels. Clearly, the service attracted more than its fair share of sadists and psychopaths, as witnessed by the memoirs of camp guard officer Ivan Chistyakov, who described the bunch of misfits who were his drunken subordinates. He called the gulag a madhouse shambles, and often dreamed of exposing his fellow officers' illiteracy and misdeeds. Perhaps the most chilling psychological insight offered by Chistyakov's diary is the portrait of a humane man conforming to an inhuman system. I'm beginning to have that mark on my face, the stamp of stupidity, Narrowness, a kind of moronic expression, he wrote. My heart is desolate. It alarms me. And the diary is also a chronicle of the essential selfishness of human suffering. Chistyakov often lamented for himself, but rarely for the inmates, whom he described as lazy and dishonest. Today, I had to imprison one woman. There's some muddle about an escape, a conflict with a phalanx leader, a knife fight, wrote Chistyakov. To hell with the lot of them. But it is they, not he, who are being starved and worked to death. To do evil, a human being must first of all believe that what he's doing is good, wrote Solzhenitsyn, or else that it's a well-considered act in conformity with natural law. Chistyakov offered no justification for the slave labour system that he was helping to run, only insight into the banality of evil. He and hundreds of thousands of other officers were only following orders, and the inhuman system of which he was a part seemed to Chistyakov as inexorable and invincible as the crushing frosts and the buzzing summer flies. In the frozen hell of Vorkuta, male prisoners were expected to work 10-hour days, reduced in March 1944 from 12 hours after too many work accidents began to impair productivity, down jerry-built and desperately unsafe coal mines. Records for the year 1945 list 7,124 serious accidents in the Vorkuta coal mines alone. Inspectors laid the blame on the shortage of miners' lamps, on electrical failures, and on the inexperience of workers. Camp life was no less harsh for the tens of thousands of women imprisoned in Vorkuta. Though spared the mines, female prisoners were nonetheless expected to perform heavy physical labour, hauling coal and water, digging ditches, working in brickworks, carrying supplies and building barracks. The women's quarters were separated from the men's by walls of barbed wire, but prisoners mixed freely during the day. Many camp guards, and also the more powerful trustees, kept women prisoners as servants and mistresses. They were often referred to as camp husbands and wives. Rape by fellow inmates and guards was prevalent. A 1955 report noted that venereal disease, abortions and pregnancies were commonplace. Pregnant women were sent to a special camp where work was lighter. A mother was allowed to stay with her child for 2 years, after which it was placed in a special nursery and the mother returned to her original camp. She received photographs and reports of the child's development and was occasionally permitted to see it. The same report noted that out of 1,000 female inmates at Vorkuta's Brickworks No. 2, 200 were suffering from tuberculosis. In the harsh conditions of the camps, prisoners formed tribes in order to survive. Poles, Balts, Ukrainians, Georgians, Armenians and Chechens all formed their own national brigades, slept separately in national barracks and organised celebrations of national holidays. Adam Galinsky, a Pole who had fought with the anti-Soviet Polish Home Army, wrote that, "We took special care of the youth and kept up its morale, the highest in the degrading atmosphere of moral decline that prevailed among the different national groups imprisoned in Vorkuta." Jews, however, were a special case. They lacked the common language and common national identity to form a coherent tribe. Many Jews, such as the influential Yiddish writer Der Nister, who died at Vorkuta in 1950, had been imprisoned for celebrating their Jewish identity. Yet they found themselves taunted and persecuted for their ethnic association with the Jewish Bolsheviks, such as Genrikh Yagoda, who had created the Gulag system. For 10 months a year, the intense cold was a constant, lethal companion of Vorkuta life. Touching a metal tool with a bare hand could tear off the skin, recalled one prisoner. Going to the bathroom was extremely dangerous. A bout of diarrhea could land you in the snow forever. And prisoners were woefully badly equipped to deal with the brutal climate. In Vorkuta, according to camp records, only 25 to 30% of prisoners had underclothes, while only 48% had warm boots. The rest had to make do with makeshift footwear made from rubber tyres and rags. The Arctic summer of Vorkuta, when the scrubland bloomed with scarlet fireweed and the low-lying landscape turned into a vast bog, was scarcely more bearable. Mosquitoes and gnats appeared in huge grey clouds, making so much noise it was impossible to hear anything else. The mosquitoes crawled up our sleeves, under our trousers, one's face would blow up from the bites, recalled a Vorkuta inmate. At the work site, we were brought lunch, and it happened that as you were eating your soup, the mosquitoes would fill up the bowl, like buckwheat porridge. They filled up your eyes, your nose, and throat, and the taste of them was sweet, like blood. Escape was unthinkable. Some of the remoter camps had no barbed wire, so unlikely was the possibility of prisoners ever making it across hundreds of kilometres of wilderness to freedom. Those that did attempt escape did so in threes, the third prisoner coming along as a cow, food for the other two in case they didn't find any other nourishment. Former prisoners frequently recall their time in the gulag as a season in another world, one with its own climate, rules, values, and even language. As Solzhenitsyn wrote, the gulag was a universe, with its own speech and codes. For camp administrators, pregnant women were books, women with children were receipts, men were accounts. Released convicts who remained in exile were rubbish, prisoners under investigation were envelopes, a camp division was a factory. Tufte was the art of pretending to work, Masturka the art of malingering. There was a rich underground culture of tattoo designs for politicals, addicts, rapists, homosexuals, murderers. The slang of the gulag soon spilled back into mainstream culture and became the slang of the entire Soviet Union. The rich vocabulary of Russian obscenity developed mainly in the camps. Occasionally, the tormented slave labourers of the gulag rose against their masters. The Vorkuta uprising of July to August 1953 was one of the bravest and most tragic of such uprisings. Stalin died in March 1953, and his chief policeman, Lavrenty Beria, was arrested shortly afterwards after a Politburo power struggle. On a warm July day, the prisoners of one Vorkuta camp downed tools, demanding that inmates have access to a state attorney and due justice. Convicts in neighbouring camps, seeing that the minehead wheels in the rebel camp had stopped spinning, joined the strike. Top brass from Moscow were sent in. The state attorney of the USSR and the commander of the internal troops tried to reason with the strikers. On July the 26th, prisoners stormed the maximum security punitive compound, releasing 77 of its inmates who had been kept in solitary cells that spelled death in wintertime. Days later, the authorities finally acted, massing armed troops to open fire on the rebels, killing 66 and wounding 135. The Vorkuta uprising changed nothing, but in Moscow, the political climate was shifting. The winner of the struggle to succeed Stalin, Nikita Khrushchev, ordered the release of hundreds of thousands of political prisoners. Later, he would denounce Stalin's crimes at a secret session of the Communist Party, and decree the re-examination of most of the political cases of the Great Terror. By the end of 1956, over 600,000 victims of the terror would be officially, posthumously, pardoned. Released prisoners were given a small sum of money and travel orders to other parts of the USSR. The vast majority remained limitchiki, forbidden to live within 101 kilometres of any major city, largely to limit the political fallout of their stories on the communist faith or urban citizens. The remaining foreign prisoners, mostly German prisoners of war, were finally allowed home. A few found their way to the US and testified to Congress about the horrors of the gulag. Today, around 40,000 people still live in Vorkuta, many the descendants of convicts or camp guards, plus a few hardy nonagenarian women who were imprisoned there and never left. In Soviet times, Vorkuta miners and residents enjoyed a generous state subsidy for enduring the harsh conditions. Those subsidies disappeared with the end of communism, but nonetheless most of the population stayed. In the 2000s, a new gas pipeline was built, bringing new prosperity and a new generation of workers. Every year, on the 31st of October, residents meet at a monument to the victims, a small space filled with a mass of rusty barbed wire, on the spot where investigative geologist Georgi Chernov pitched his tent in 1931, effectively founding the city. But the most enduring monument to the victims of the Gulag remains in the printed words of the survivors, the stories of their lives and their battle not just to live, but to retain their humanity. Reading a simple litany of horrors quickly ceases to be meaningful. As Boris Pasternak wrote of the man-made famine that killed millions in the Ukraine in the early 1930s, there was such inhuman, unimaginable misery, such a terrible disaster, that it began to seem almost abstract. It would not fit within the bounds of consciousness. Reading about the Gulag begins to seem like a story of another planet, too distant for comprehension. But listen to how Varlam Shalamov, a writer who survived 17 years in Kolyma in the Soviet Far East, defined what it meant to feel fully human in the Gulag. "I believed a person could consider himself a human being as long as he felt totally prepared to kill himself," a character says in one of Shalamov's Kolyma tales. "It was this awareness that provided the will to live. I checked myself frequently and felt I had the strength to die, and thus remained alive." Both he and Silke lived, and that was their victory. The last word must go to Alexander Solzhenitsyn. "I dedicate this to all those who did not live to tell it," he wrote in the foreword to his classic study, The Gulag Archipelago. "And may they please forgive me for not having seen it all, nor remembered it all, for not having divined all of it."
We hope you've enjoyed Silke's Journey, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Press. Production supervised by Catherine Carroll. Text copyright 2019 by Heather Morris. Production copyright 2019 by Bonnier Books UK. All rights reserved.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Enderlin. I'm the publisher of St. Martin's Press, and I'm here with Heather Morris, author of The Tattooist of Auschwitz and Silke's Journey.
Hello.
Heather, I love to picture you writing The Tattooist of Auschwitz because it begins with you kind of interviewing Lolly, like you were just sitting at a different, probably different tables, different restaurants. How did that literally come about? He'd talk and you'd write?
No, not at all. In fact, I never used the word interview. I never interviewed him. I sat and listened to him.
So you didn't write as he was talking? You just listened?
I never recorded. I never wrote. He was an 87-year-old man. He would not have been able to tolerate me sitting there taking notes. He just needed to talk, and he wanted somebody's full, undivided attention.
Wow.
So no notes, no recording, until probably about 6 or 7 months after I met him, and he was now comfortable with me. And he'd already told me his story, and that's when I said to him, "Okay, darling, I'm going to put a camera in front of you." And he agreed.
When he was first telling you his story and you gave him your undivided attention, did you then go back to your own home and write down notes? Or
frantically.
Frantically wrote down notes.
Yes. And he would say things, and he'd use words that I didn't understand. And he would often flip between English, which was this delightful Eastern European accent that he had. Mm-hmm. But suddenly he would be talking to me in Slovakian. Then he'd throw in a little bit of German for good measure. And he'd use phrases that I was unfamiliar with, and I'd have to try and remember them. He would talk about people. Well, he was Commandant Schwarzhuber. He was Schwarzhuber. Mm-hmm. You know, who's Schwarzhuber? I couldn't ask him. You couldn't break his chain of talk. But when I was finished with him each time I met him, then I would say, "Last time you mentioned a guy called Schwarzhuber, who was he?" and tell me how to spell his name so I can look him up. So I would do it that way. Because one of the things about talking to Lully and to any older person, particularly about an event that's traumatic or tragic, you need to do the right thing in caring for them. You need to shut them down before you leave them. And I knew that. I knew that I, before I left him, start talking about something other than the subject matter.
How long into the process of talking to him, how long until Silke's name came up?
Probably 3 or 4 months. And then it was just a fleeting, did I tell you about Silke? No, Lally, who was Silke? Silke, well, she was this tiny little thing. And he, not saying who he was way up here and he'd indicate way above his own head. And I go, who are they? And he said, Silke. And I went, and who is Silke? Silke saved my life. And then he was gone.
And so you had to remember that little nugget and then bring it back to him. And did it take a few tries before he really got going on Silke?
Yeah, many. Because trying to introduce her into his flow of what he was wanting to talk about each day, you needed to let him finish what he was talking about and then tell me some more about Silke. And then the day he looked at me and he got so serious and he went, she was the bravest person I ever met. Not the bravest girl, the bravest person.
Did you know, even as you were talking to Lally, that someday you would tell Silke's story as well?
Hearing Silke's name from Lally, I then went and watched a Showa tape that he made several years earlier and one that Geeta made several years earlier. And they both talked about Silke. They talked about her role in Auschwitz-Birkenau. And Geeta talked about meeting up with her again several times when she went back to Slovakia. They'd already told me that she had been sent to Siberia. And so here I was now hearing that Geeta had visited her in Slovakia. Aha, she's alive.
I think the appeal and the profound impact that The Tattooist of Auschwitz has had on readers is that it describes the fact that you can still find hope in hopeless places, and you can still find love even when there's death all around you. And I'm wondering, was Silke able to find hope in a hopeless place?
For Silke, being sent to another prison, having just survived 3 years in Auschwitz, it surely must have drained her of any hope that she could ever get back to her family, ever have a normal life. But we're not dealing with any ordinary young girl here. This is a young girl for whom survival mattered. Now, I think it's Eli Wiesel who says, hope is the last thing to die. Our organs will shut down. We will give up on love. But we will always cling to hope until with our last breath.
She did survive, we know that, and we know that she met Geeta once or twice after the war, or many times. Were you able to tell?
Lally never left Australia from the day that he came in 1949. Geeta, however, returned back to Slovakia on several occasions. Two of her brothers survived, and she went back to visit them because they couldn't get out. So she would go back, and I know from Geeta's Showa tape that she met Silke on every one of those occasions. So I think we're talking maybe 3 or 4 and spent time with her. And I'm not sure how Silke would have actually explained Geeta away to her neighbours and friends in Košice, because Silke never let on to anybody in Košice, where she now lived with her husband, that she had been in either Auschwitz or a gulag.
She reinvented herself after the war and after the Siberian sentencing. She reinvented herself. Did she change her name after, or did she change a variation of her name? How did she shut off that part of her life?
Silke, at some point when she was in the gulag, decided to kill off Silke of old. She took her real name, the name that she was given at birth, of Cecilia, and nobody knew her ever again as anything but Cecilia. And when I met neighbours and people who knew her in Kosciuszko less than 12 months ago, they were shocked that I kept talking about somebody called Silke. And we had to work it out that Silke, Klein, and Cecilia Kovacova were the same person.
You've traveled around and met so many readers of Tattooist of Auschwitz. Have readers been asking you about Silke?
I've already indicated that from the moment Lali mentioned her name and described her as the bravest person he ever met, that I wanted to know more about her. And I'd started some research, and then The Tattooist of Auschwitz came out. I have been flooded with thousands of emails from around the world, many of them in a language I can't read and we have to get translated. One theme stood out in so many of these emails. What happened to Silke? I can't believe that I've now read in the back of your book that this young girl got sent to a gulag. I've been trying to Google Silke. I can't find anything about her anywhere. Tell me more. And I was starting to write back what I little bit I knew, and then I went, okay, folks, you want to know about Silke? I'll tell you about Silke. So I spoke to my publishers in London, and I said, Silke? And they went, Silke.
What do you think it is that makes people, all these decades later, still fascinated in Holocaust stories and stories of World War II, and now in stories of things that happened in the 1950s in Russia that just seemed so unfair? I mean, there's unfair things happening in this day and age, too, but what do you think it is that particularly turns us to that time period? Perhaps I might ask if it's because you can still almost reach it and find people who are still alive who can bear witness to it. What are your thoughts on this?
I think we're living in interesting times. And when I thought about when I got Lali's story back in 2006 and foolishly hung on to it as a screenplay, wanting to see it played out on a screen, big or small, I didn't care, that I didn't turn it into a book back then was probably a good thing. I think my timing has turned out to be just right. And I think that's because there's so much going on in the world which we feel that we cannot help, we cannot do anything about. And I'm talking about the situation in places like Syria and parts of Africa. And we feel a sense of, well, there's kind of community guilt about it. But there's also the fact that we can access information more readily. Now, this story has come out and it's been successful because it's about one person. I'm talking about the tattooist. It's about one person, or two really. I suppose we should count Geeta. But it's one man's story. The story of the Holocaust, of the millions of people who not only died but survived not to go on and have a good life. In the enormity of that, it's hard to grasp, it's hard to picture. But you can relate to one person. Now, with Silke, I want you to relate to the one person. But you can extrapolate that to millions. Learn about the one, and you'll learn about the millions. And that's what I'm hoping Silke's journey will do for people, because those gulags are an untouched source of storylines. Not too much has been written about them in a fictional sense. It's time that was changed.
We cannot wait to have this book reach all the millions of readers that we know it will reach. It's so exciting.